I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this April 25th Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. Today on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick talks to Steve Bloom, worker, poet, and Marxist intellectual. In his recent writings, Steve Bloom has been discussing the sea change in U.S. political consciousness, such that people are discussing the 99% and the 1%, and that Bernie Sanders can call himself a democratic socialist and win primary elections across the country. Bill and Steve will talk about how the left can operate to build movements that could prevail as our current system moves into deeper economic and environmental crisis. Book Mole, Larry Bolden reviews Lies and Other Acts of Love by Christy Woodson Harvey. In her new book, the Dear Carolina author tackles love and what it really means to tell the truth. I'm your host, Denise Morris, and I will conclude today's show by looking back at Robert Drew's 1960 documentary film Primary, The Byrne Hillary Campaign and Objectivity in Reporting. The Old Mole Variety Hour thanks you for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members old and new for supporting KBOO programs like the Old Mole Variety Hour, 20 years and counting. You can call in this morning. We'll be talking to you about how you can become a member later in the show. And remember, you can find the Old Mole on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick and Steve Bloom.
Hi, Denise. Thank you. Steve Bloom, welcome to KBOO.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here.
Steve Bloom writes poetry. He also writes on politics. He organizes poetry evenings in New York City for radicals. As to the poetry, in our next membership break, Steve will lead off with one of his poems. He's making his first book of poems. It's called The Time I Stopped to Watch. He's making it available to KBOO folks who renew or become members. As to his strategic political work, Steve, you've recently been examining the sea change in U.S. political consciousness, the 99% of the 1%, the Bernie Sanders phenomena. Socialism's move from dirty word to real option. It can be discussed as an alternative to our current system. That's quite remarkable. Who would have ever thought that 10 or 15 years ago? Steve, tell us briefly about the sea change. Why is it happening? What are its roots?
Well, in some ways, you can't really tell why something like this happens. In retrospect, you know, there's climate change and the potential catastrophe, which is looming and that the corporate establishment is doing nothing about. The economy has been a disaster for working people for a long time. And at some point, people just decide they're fed up with it and they're going to do something. I remember during the anti-Vietnam War movement when, it was the same thing. You wouldn't have imagined in 1965 that within 3 or 4 years there would be a million people in the streets. The changes happen, and sometimes we don't always know why. Why was it the Vietnam War that created that crisis? But whatever's happening, it's real. I think it's clear that it's real.
Part of it, just to briefly to comment, of course, there were movements like the civil rights movement. No one would have imagined how a black struggle in the 50s. And yet there were all of these antecedents, people struggling at the molecular level, building sort of groups and fighting ideas and creating newspapers and music that sort of anticipated it. I'm sure you agree with that.
Yeah, there are always small groups, even in the leanest of times. There are people who are engaged in struggle. Yeah. And at some point, those small struggles just spark off a big response in society as a whole. We seem to be in that moment. We're getting into that moment. I would say we're in the early stages of the process.
Yeah, in fact, I think I'm going to claim some credit for KBOO Radio and being one of those voices that are not dominant. We have a smaller audience than Fox News, I'm afraid, but there's all kinds of us all over the country, and the word gets out, particularly when people are receptive. Steve, let's talk about the manifestations of it fairly briefly, so people give us a sense of what's happening now, the whole sort of spectrum of it.
Well, you know, it's hard to give the whole spectrum in a minute or two, but the big things are fairly obvious. Millions of people are embracing Bernie Sanders and his message, what he calls socialism. And whether we agree with that use of the term or not, it is quite amazing that millions of people are embracing it. The big climate march in New York last year was a clear manifestation, with virtually everyone carrying signs that identified capitalism as the problem. You're not necessarily going to have that unanimity in terms of projecting solutions, but the people were all identifying capitalism as the problem. When the cops kill an unarmed black youth these days, you know, a few years ago, the response was a modest local protest. Now the protests are citywide, regional, even national. Big-time sports stars start putting on I Can't Breathe T-shirts. So these are the kinds of things that are happening, and I'm sure if we sat and thought about it, we could name all kinds of others. But that kind of captures the
right. You know, yeah, I'd actually like to name a few others, and then we can go into our station break. So have your poetry ready. You know, I was reading recently about a group of corporate advisors and business school professors who held a conference, and the name of the conference was Capitalism in Question, believe it or not. And some of the questions, listen to this, what kind of economic system would a better world be built upon? Would it be a capitalist economic system? If so, what kind of capitalism? Then, if not, what would it be? Now, these are business school professors. I suppose they're hearing from some of their students. There are actually radicals who go to business schools, you know, in order to learn some of the skills of maneuvering in capitalism. I think that's pretty amazing. You wouldn't have found that 10 or 15 years ago. And then there's all
no,
of
it's
the...
Actually, yeah. It's actually one of the signs of a general shift in sentiment, the developing radicalization, is that even those in power begin to question their own assumptions about the world,
yeah,
and how to rule the world.
And some of them get very disturbed that the companies that they're advising don't listen to them in their furious drive for more profits. Steve, you're also a poet, and you write a lot in various places, mostly obscure, I'm afraid. I'm going to do a little station break now, and then we'll do your poetry, and then we will go to Pledge Central to talk to Linda and Bill, tell the audience about KBOO. Steve, why don't you read a poem from your first book?
Okay.
And then
it's actually my second book, but it's okay. The poem is called April 10th, 2006, New York City. Sometimes politics proves to be as strange as poetry. Never thought that I would feel at home in a demonstration where one American flag follows another after another after another. But today, it's not the usual my country can beat up your country crowd. No, this time, it's the invisible people speaking out loud for a change. I am Haitian. I am Korean. I am Pakistani, they tell me. I am Dominican. I am Mexicana. I am Filipino. I am Ethiopian. I am Jamaican. I am Guatemalan. And I live here, too. I will not be less of a human being than you. I fly the flag of my country, and I fly the flag of my other country. For whether I am there or here, your nation would collapse without the work I do. So I stand, watching, ask myself whether we have, perhaps, just taken one small step towards today, when every human being will at last fly every flag of every nation and still feel at home.
Well, that was from Steve Bloom's second book, The Time I Stopped to Watch. Steve.
I'm still here.
You're still there. Good. You'll have to ask your publisher to print up more copies of the book. I hope it's really worth reading and fun.
I make them by hand myself. So however many you need, I have them promised.
You are a true revolutionary in the Karl Marx's great sense of
I try to avoid the craziness of the publishing world.
A worker in the day, a publisher in the evening, a poet all the time, and a good friend. Steve Bloom, we're going to return to the interview. In the first half, the bring people up to date. Steve and I, who's a poet and a writer, we discussed the sea change in political consciousness exemplified by the Bernie Sanders campaign and the considerable depth of questioning of capitalism and searching for its replacement all over society, and it's sort of growing. Steve, let's follow up on that. How should people who see capitalism today as profoundly destructive of human life and the natural world, what's your sense of those of us who are still a relatively small minority but growing fast, and it seems as if we're entering a period of upheaval and tumult as capital really can't respond to its great challenges as it just keeps driving ahead to try and accumulate. Steve, what should we be doing?
Well, it seems to me that the first thing people have to do, and I find not everyone recognizes the kinds of changes that we've been talking about. So that's the first thing, is to get out of the old mindset where we were in small isolated groups and not having much influence, and understand that we can get out there in the world and try to influence people. And then find ways to explain that just voting for Bernie Sanders or forming the Democratic Party or other incremental changes in establishment institutions aren't going to bring about even the kind of political revolution that Sanders is talking about, not to mention the more profound kind of social revolution we need, one that's going to sweep away this whole system based on supremacy and corporate greed. The key is learning to promote struggles for reform in ways that help to strengthen the independent mobilization of working people and oppressed communities, people acting for themselves. Our goal has to be to create a system which will actually be run democratically from below rather than by officials from the top. And before we can do that, people have to have experience running their own struggles and their own independent organizations. If we go to establishment state institutions, it has to be with clear demands for action that we have formulated ourselves based on our needs, not based on what's practical for those in power or compatible with the system of profit. And you see a lot of those kinds of practical proposals, for example, in the environmental movement, where people will focus on how to make renewable energy more profitable. And some of those are reasonable and good proposals, but making things profitable can't be our overall strategy if we agree that the primary enemy of the environment is the system of profit-making. And I would say not just enemy of the environment, but the enemy of humanity in so many ways. So it's a matter of creating our own institutions, the way Black Lives Matter, for example, created its own institutions, and labor unions can be a similar kind of thing when they aren't dominated by privileged conservative bureaucracies.
Yeah, let me challenge that a little bit. The radical left is fairly weak. We don't have sort of a mass base, but there's a tremendous left out there that is in tension between, it seems to me, very radical possibilities and these sort of practical things that you might win. Take like 350.org. It's a tremendous organization, at least in Portland, and the Sierra Club in Portland, and many other groups that find themselves fighting on sort of various fronts, but that in fact, if you go to their meetings and you read their materials and you read Bill Kibben's books and you go to their rallies, which I do, and work within them, what you find is that most of the people are very critical of the system as it exists now and realize that immense changes have to be made, and furthermore, that those changes have to be democratic. That is, they really move towards a vision of, let's say, energy democracy versus maintaining the system we have now. Energy democracy is a sort of buzzword that people really respond to. It seems to me that those movements of so many people in almost every area of life, the immigration rights movement, the anti-war movement, the continuation of civil rights and poverty movements, many different environmental movements, they all have that sort of mixed quality. We have to somehow get some legislation passed for which they often give away much too much, and we can be critical of that, and where the leadership of it then tells the members to, well, don't be too critical. That's what we have to do. But they're also just filled with critical ideas and real democratic aspirations. It seems to me that's an area that a left can work in and not just trying to pull people out and become revolutionary somehow in their sect, but where it can work on and build democratic values and ideas and help develop those aspirations and even model them themselves. Anyway, that's my long-winded question.
Well, that's a good question.
You have to...
I would set an example here in New York. There's been a struggle against fracking, big struggle against fracking in New York State, which actually won a concession from Governor Cuomo of New York, who banned fracking in New York. It's a big, big victory and a big development. Well, you can draw two conclusions from that. One is Governor Cuomo is now our ally, and isn't it wonderful? Which a whole wing of the environmental movement has kind of moved in that direction. But the right conclusion is Governor Cuomo only did that because he was afraid of what we would do if he didn't. And we have to keep up that pressure and keep up our own independent organization. The extent to which we make concessions on policy to get some little concession somewhere else, to that extent we weaken ourselves and we weaken our struggles. The anti-Vietnam War movement is kind of my favorite example of this because it won the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Vietnam by demanding the withdrawal of troops from Vietnam. And there were lots of people who wanted to demand negotiations and would have seen just some negotiated settlement. But the majority of the movement stood firm for troops out now. And we were able to achieve that. In part, obviously, the Vietnamese contributed greatly to that victory with their struggles. But the movement in the United States, and the Vietnamese will tell you, the movement in the United States demanding out now contributed significantly to their success. So it's true, we do have to win incremental changes, such as the ban on hydrofracking. It is a tremendous victory in New York. But we can't think that that's our ultimate goal.
Steve, we have to wrap
all right,
up.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for talking. You know, all things must end, but they can also then begin again sometime, and you're going to have to answer the question that I posed, actually, and I'm going to ask it in this way. Why are you doing your poetry, which is in some ways a sort of, you can see it as sort of inspiring people and public education. It's not, in fact, building groups or making demands. It's building consciousness, and I want to talk about building consciousness sometime with you. Thanks a lot for talking to us today, and your book is, give us the title, Steve.
It's The Time I Stopped to Watch.
And you wrote, you're really a good reader. It was a great poem. Thanks a lot, and we'll talk again.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning. Beginning with a quote from the book. My mama always told me that honesty was the most important thing in life, but I've never understood why people are so hell-bent on honesty. It's not the truth that sets you free. The truth is the thing that destroys lives, that shatters the mirror. The truth is selfish and shameful and better kept to oneself. In fact, I'm quite sure that the only thing that paperclips any of our lives together are the white lies. They are the defibrillators that bring us back when we were on the brink of succumbing to the light. Close quote. So begin Lynn White's, known by all as Lovey, Discourse on Marriage and Families. Christy Woodson Harvey's little book, Lies and Other Acts of Love, is a lighthearted but serious look at love and relationships and the role that honesty and what she calls white lies both hold together and shatter families. This is not a great book. There's an economic snobbery about it that offended me some throughout, and yet I found myself entertained and sometimes deeply moved by the relationships described in what appears to be a rather intimately autobiographical novel. There are two narrators, the matriarch of the family, Lynn, Lovey, who has five daughters, and Annabelle, a granddaughter, who is as stiff and unforgiving as her grandmother Lovey is fluid and compassionate and forgiving. Like so many modern novels, this one flips back and forth between narrators and between epics. Lovey tells her story of how she came to love and marry Dan, also known as Daddy D, in the 1940s, and Annabelle, speaking in the present, describes her deteriorating marriage to a musician, Ben, and her attempts to unravel family secrets that threaten to explode her rosy view of what she sees as the perfect marriage and family of her grandmother, Lovey and Daddy D. In the present, with all of their daughters raised and most of them married, Lovey's beloved Dan is suffering from Alzheimer's, and she's doing her best to care for him at home. In one of his rare moments of lucidity in the middle of the night, Dan wakes to ask Lovey, "Can I get you anything?" And when she replies, "Not a thing, sweetheart. Are you all right?" his reply, "As long as you're here, I'm perfect," which is always his reply. The description of the love between Dan and Lovey is, I think, the high point of the novel. Lovey is a wise and caring person who treats her daughters with great respect, encouraging them to live their own lives as they see fit and to trust their instincts. She does not insist on always getting at the truth, realizing that there are times when attention and caring are more important than the truth. Annabelle, on the other hand, is rigid and uncompromising in her pursuit of truth, although in the end, with the help of her grandmother and an Episcopal priest that she begins to work for, she begins to see that some things, for example, keeping families together, may be more important than omissions and white lies. Through questioning and snooping, Annabelle gets closer and closer to revealing a truth about the distant past that could shatter the lives of those in her close-knit family. This little element of mystery in the book makes it more enticing as a story, as well as raising questions about the relative importance of truth compared to loyalty and family solidarity. While there are parts of the book that are soap opera sentimental and some religious overtones that this reader found to be detracting from the quality of the story as a whole, the insights into what make relationships good ones and on just how deceit can quickly destroy a relationship are worth the sentimentality and the not-so-subtle evangelical elements. Lovey notes that while the death of her 89-year-old husband is not tragic, it is devastating, as she says. It is, most of all, a death of the self. Just so, the partner who is left is no longer who she or he was in the partnership, and yet there is no new whole person to replace the self that is lost. Another thing that is taken up in the book, and I think dealt with quite skillfully, is the need for friendships outside of marriage. You should not worry about moving to a new town with your husband, according to Lovey, because in reality your husband is the only friend you need. That was a lovely sentiment, but as I was learning, maybe not a totally true one. I loved Ben madly, but I needed friends. Close quote. I think many relationships cave in on themselves precisely because there is too much weight put on them and not enough importance attached to friendships aside from the marriage. Annabelle certainly comes to realize this, but as is so often the case, she does not really see or act on the need for friends until her marriage is crumbling, which makes it all the harder to seek out support and counsel from others. Fortunately, she does have her wise old grandmother, Lovey, although she almost loses her too by being too insistent on the perfection she wants, by keeping Lovey and her grandfather on pedestals that cannot be maintained. I'd read a dozen or so war novels and psychological thrillers before stumbling on this little book, which is both lighthearted and deceptively deep. I was ready for it and found it delightful. I've been talking about Christy Woodson Harvey's 2016 novel, Lies and Other Acts of Love. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thanks, folks. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Denise Morris, this morning, and Patricia Kohlberg has been our fearless engineer through our membership drive this morning, and thanks to folks for calling in. We'll get back to some more good stuff on why KBOO is so great, but first I want to talk a little bit about a great documentary film, Primary. Something historic is happening. This is what we hear daily from pundits, politicians, analysts, and not the least from a hopeful electorate. Does that sound familiar? It was 8 years ago. The historic Democratic Party race was between a white woman and an African-American man. Both would be first in the U.S. if one could be elected president. And we all know how this turned out, with now President Barack Obama becoming the first black president elected in 2008 and again in 2012. So here we are again, a white woman, Hillary Clinton, and a Jewish socialist, Bernie Sanders, campaigning for the Democratic Party nomination for president. It's 2016, and many of us standing on the margins of party politics are unclear about the nature of this historic event, what it means or will mean come November. Clinton and the burn leave a lot to be desired. Clinton, the establishment candidate against Bernie Sanders, a longtime senator whose socialist politics, while they might look a little more social democrat, democratic socialist to the left, have had a broad appeal to Americans living in times of extreme inequality and uncertainty. But let's not forget about hope. What is historic is not the players so much as the national conversation building around socialism and a viable alternative to advanced global capitalism. Elections do bring a saturation of the airwaves, along with a careful orchestration of events, actions, and speeches. The spectacle is well controlled, lest every misstep go viral. But not so before the days of social media, YouTube, iPhones, and the like. Something historic is happening is also what documentary filmmaker Robert Drew said 48 years ago. Well, it's been actually longer than that. 1960. My math is a little off here. But at any rate, Drew and cameraman Richard Leacock, filmmaker D.A. Pennebaker, and a small crew filmed the Wisconsin Democratic Party primary that was in 1960, and the battle was between John F. Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey. For the Drew associates, the historic moment was not the event itself, it was the capturing of the event that was historic. How the film was made was a revolution in documentary filmmaking in the United States. Their film primary was the result of a 3-year collaboration between Drew and Leacock involving the development of a handheld camera, sound sync technology, and the rethinking of a traditional journalism and reporting. The camera had to be lightweight enough to be carried for long periods of time and maneuvered in difficult and undirected circumstances. The Wisconsin primary was a perfect beginning, a here-and-now current event involving two high-profile politicians with two very distinct personalities and approaches. With their portable equipment, the film crew were able to follow the candidates as they navigated back roads in big cities, selling themselves and their ideas to large crowds in small places. The Drew associates worked in teams following Kennedy and Humphrey through 5 days of campaigning. They even managed to capture the candidates as they waited for election results to trickle in. In the late 50s, Robert Drew was working as an editor for Life magazine, specializing in the candid still picture essay. He began to think of this form of journalism as, quote, lectures with picture illustrations. Real life never got out of the film. Drew was looking for a journalism constructed of moving pictures. The challenge, he believed, would be to, quote, drop word logic and find a dramatic logic in which things really happen. He described the end product as, quote, a theater without actors, plays without playwrights, reporting without summary and opinion. The ability to look in on people's lives at crucial times from which you could deduce certain things and see a kind of truth that can only be gotten through personal experience. Drew, Leacock, and Pennebaker do not tell us what to think. They use insight, skill, and artistry to demonstrate what it was like to be there. Kennedy and Humphrey had to be willing participants. They had to trust the filmmakers and not try to control what was filmed. They were encouraged to forget the camera. Cameraman Richard Leacock described the process as fishing or hunting. Leacock also recalls very specific guidelines for engaging the subject. Quote, never ask someone to repeat a line. Never ask someone to repeat an action. Not because it was immoral, but because it doesn't work. The small crews were to remain unobtrusive, no interventions, no interviews. Kennedy and Humphrey proved to be very effective subjects. The film has very little narration, less than 30 seconds in a 53-minute film. We hear crowds, cars, speeches, conversation, all a matter of moving with the subject. The narrative of the film is a result of action, personality, and editing. Humphrey, a senator from neighboring state of Minnesota, is up against newcomer John F. Kennedy, junior senator of Massachusetts. Humphrey digs his heels in the rural areas, attempting to appeal to farming interests and regular folk. Humphrey is an everyman, not particularly special, just a guy on the street whose jokes fall flat and promises run thin. Men are his base, the front line. Women stand in the shadows. Kennedy is the millionaire Easterner, handsome, articulate, funny, charisma for days. He is a rock star, signing autographs and shaking hands as he works the Metropolitan stage, wife by his side. Women are everywhere, active participants. Girls too young to vote think he's dreamy. Kennedy speaks of threats to our freedom, the welfare of our great country, integrity, judgment, competence, our national courage, our duty. Humphrey talks about farm subsidies, his practicality drowning in Kennedy's rhetoric, which today is eerie, as his red menace has been replaced with the war on terror. Primary is a remarkable film. Robert Drew led his team in an effort to innovate by simply allowing the camera to capture events as they happened. Drew invested in the idea that the power of the event itself could deliver drama, insight, knowledge. One reviewer suggests that the Drew Associates documented an event that played out the emergence of what we now understand to be the cult of personality. We don't see strategies for winning an election. We see characters, real-life characters. Quote, "This is a documentary about image and vision, a testament to how character and high recognizability can and would eventually win out over issues and party political machine institutionalization." While Primary has been considered a breakthrough in North American cinema verite, Drew prefers direct cinema. The handheld camera is the same, but cinema verite is understood to be more intrusive, wanting to provoke, reveal. Direct cinema has been seen as more observational. It rests on the belief that the presence of the camera does not substantially alter the recorded event. Direct cinema can sound apolitical or perhaps holding the idea supporting the notions of objectivity in reporting, but in fact, direct cinema emerged in the 1960s from, quote, "a desire to test common opinion with reality, an attempt to show things how things really are." But still, it is important to acknowledge the viewer's lens, shaded as it is by cultural beliefs and norms. Reality is subject to interpretation, and there is a great risk in that what is presented as real and true appears to be natural and unchangeable. Questions about authenticity, truth, and objectivity in reporting aside, Primary is well worth a look back. It is a beautiful antidote to the pounding from social media and entertainment journalism we are about to endure. You can find Primary on DVD free at the Multnomah County Library or online. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this is Denise Morris.
I can't hear you say it. Y'all ain't ready. I can't hear you say it.
That is Prince and the New Power Generation with The War. That's a 26-minute jam, if anyone wants to pick that up, if you need a 26-minute jam from Prince. R.I.P. Prince. KBOO Radio, I'm Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We're wrapping it up this morning. I want to thank our guests, Steve Bloom. We also had our book mole, Larry Bolden, in this morning, and, of course, Bill Resnick here with me now. Bill, any last words for our members and future members out there?
Next week, we're going to have a show on parenting, on radical parenting, and how, in fact, parenting has so changed in this country over the last 50 years. It's very, very remarkable. And what it expresses is this sort of democratic, radically democratic sort of notions that are flowing through the society, even through people who don't consider themselves to be radical Democrats or socialists. They are practicing a very different kind of parenting, involving kids a lot more in decision-making. Anyway, that's next week. Thanks a lot for listening. What was your final comments?
That's it, everyone. Just thanks for listening. Thanks for calling in. Thanks for becoming members and for renewing memberships. We will be back next week with that program.
Don't we talk about how people can also find our shows on archives and stuff like that?
Yes, on KBOO's website. That's Old Mole Variety Hour /KBOO. Let's see, KBOO.FM/Old Mole Variety Hour.
Yes, and you can hear Steve Bloom reading his poem. You know, he's a good poem reader.
He is good. Okay, we're out. Thank you.